Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new name. We're calling this Permaculture Central because most of my shows are about permaculture, and I'm the only person on the Blog Talk Network talking about permaculture, other than our special guest today, Paul Wheaton, who happens to be on the same show.
Well, I'm not on the Blog Talk Network, so I...
Well, you are via me.
Well, yes, true. That's true. But you talk to lots of people besides me.
I do, but if you type in Paul Wheaton in Blog Talk, you show up.
Oh, good.
Yes. So that's good to know.
I get to infect brains all that I want, and I don't have to do any of the work.
Right.
Well, I like this.
Yeah, well, today we have a topic that is absolutely a dimension of permaculture, and it is perhaps one of the most difficult dimensions to design.
I want to take out the word perhaps.
Okay.
And I want to say, and I think we have to emphasize that people can do permaculture without doing this aspect. And the emphasis that I want to make is that this aspect is 20 times more complicated than all the rest of permaculture put together.
But the only way they can do it without this aspect is if they live alone.
Which is fine. You know,
I
want to make it clear, because sometimes when we talk about this, some people feel like, oh, I can't do permaculture because I don't want to do that thing.
Which we haven't mentioned yet.
I'm waiting for you to mention it. It's your show, man.
All right. Today we're talking about community. And that's a lot of different things. So Paul chose this topic. I'm going to let him. He's going to talk about community, and then we're going to go from there.
Well, specifically about what's oftentimes referred to as intentional community. And even in intentional community, that can mean so many different things. But I think the thing we want to talk about is having something like a bunch of people living under one roof. And so then the complicated part is when you think back to your college days, it's like, oh, yeah, I did that. That was terrible. And granted, some people think back on their college days, and it's like, oh, that was great. And it's kind of like, well, why aren't you living that way now? Oh, you know, I have a family, and I don't, you know, whatever. But there's actually great big masses of adults that still to this day do this. And there was a movie out recently. What was that movie called? Wanderlust. Was it Wanderlust? I don't know if you saw it.
I didn't see it.
It was a Hollywood movie. It was in the theaters. And it was about a bunch of people living under one roof. And they, during the movie, they said, oh, it's not a commune anymore. It's intentional community. And I really believe that when I'm thinking of intentional community today, it's definitely not a commune. It's nothing like it. And then there was such a massive failure rate of the communes back in the day. There's a very good reason for that failure rate. But okay, what a massive, massive, massive topic. Getting, and I usually refer to it as, how do you get 20 people to live under one roof without stabbing each other? And I think that inside that message comes the real crux of the problem, which is that of the drama, the people not getting along, conflicts and personality, etc. But I think we should probably, before we get into all of that, we should talk about why should we care, and what are the upsides. So I would have to say that for me, having now I've done some community experimentation in the last 8 years or so, and I have to say that at the very top of my list is the part where you share meals. It's like the amount that you learn at the table is phenomenal. It's like you're just not going to learn this much spending all day long on the internet. You're going to learn more sharing 3 meals a day with a community than you will surfing the internet all day. I believe that to be true. What do you think, Paul?
I absolutely agree. But it's interesting because people value different things. So you value learning at the table, and I value the people aspect of it, the sharing and the building of, you know, the people relationship aspect of it. So this is where, when you're living in community, it's important to understand other people's perspectives. So one person might be into knowledge, and we talked about something called the Enneagram. On the Enneagram, someone who's talking about knowledge might be what's called a 5. I'm good for what I know. That's how he values himself. Now, I'm a 7 on the Enneagram, which says I'm happy. So the 7 without people wouldn't be very happy. So the 7 needs people and enjoys people. That conversation, that table, like you're saying, is very, very critical. If you're not meeting at the table for meals, you're kind of not getting a lot about community.
Sure.
Yeah. So go on.
All right.
I agree with you.
I another thing is, if you've got 20 people living under one roof, then what it takes to keep these people happy, as far as expense for just dollars. I wanted to say eco footprint, but I'm going to change that to just dollars. And pretty much the dollars to make everybody be happy is about half that as if they're each living in their own apartment or home. And so I kind of like the idea of, like, now it costs half as much, then if everybody spends the same, then everybody can have twice as much. I really like the idea that for less money than what people are spending now, they can live far more luxuriantly. Another thing is that when we start talking about, like, a lot of the world problems, I'm not sure if I've mentioned this on your program before, but I believe that for all world problems, that the solution lies in permaculture and homesteading universally. I've kind of put it out there, like, okay, I challenge people to come up with a world problem that is not solved by homesteading and permaculture. I'm up for it. Let's take that on. But as we start to explore these, one of the tools in the tool set is it's like, well, if you've got 20 people living under one roof, then here's how quality of life can be improved. And so I think the thing to do is, and I think for a lot of the people that are interested in permaculture, the upsides are pretty easy. You can get the cost of everything to be cut at least in half, sometimes more. Chores are oftentimes reduced by the number of people that are in the house. And so there's some chores that need to be done regardless of how many people are inside the house. And so now it's like, oh, okay, the work that needs to be done is greatly reduced. Rather than, if you're one person in one house, now you have to own all these chores, make sure all these chores get done. Now you can live a much lazier life. Now, of course, there's some things that the chores become larger because there's 20 people instead of one person. But a lot of times, it's the workload is doubled even though there's 20 people instead of one, or maybe it's tripled. You're still operating far more efficiently.
And there's that old saying, many hands make light work.
True.
Yeah.
True. So there's a social aspect. There's oftentimes music every night and nobody's turned on a radio.
Right.
It seems like there's always people with instruments and they got to play. And so perpetual music.
And jokes constantly, skits. I mean, there's just so many, I don't know, a lot of entertainers within the group, I would say.
Life, the quality of life in general, I would say, goes way up. Life becomes rich and delicious. Now, we've just touched on a list of the upsides. I mean, I think that the upsides list can go on for hundreds of items, but I don't think we need to dwell too much on the upsides. The downsides. I went and I visited in 2005. I think I visited like a dozen different intentional communities. And I made it a habit to exit the people that were leaving the community and ask them, why? Why are you leaving? And, of course, I can easily find people that are either moving into the community, the people that have just arrived are full of information on why they love it there and why it's so great. But most of the communities I visited, that I could not find anybody in the communities that had been there longer than 2 years. And so it's like these people that are so happy to arrive and so ecstatic, it's like you think to yourself, in 2 years, they're going to be saying the same things as the people that are leaving today. And so I would do these exit interviews, and why are you leaving? And it's like, well, it's mostly the drama. And so, but these communities were, what you would refer to as modern-day intentional communities. Their form of self-governance was generally consensus. And now, granted, a lot of communities are moving away from consensus because of these problems. And I think a lot of this is that when you design a community in the beginning, people design the structures and the decision-making process with while depending on all people who are part of the community to be more than human, to be above being human, to be noble, to be rather pure and decent, as opposed to like a normal person. And it turns out that if you design your system that way, everything comes crashing down. Everything falls apart. So I guess just much like the upsides, I think that for a lot of people, they can easily imagine the downsides. So now the mission is how do we make the upsides better, and can we reduce the downsides? And I think as we look around, we can find where there are 20 people living under one roof, and it doesn't have to be 20. It can be maybe 6. Maybe it's going to be 40. But these different numbers of people living under one roof, unrelated people, and find examples of it working. And my first thoughts lead to the idea of like an old folks' home. Those people are living under one roof, and they're not getting along perfectly. I don't think there's going to ever be an example of them getting along perfectly, but they definitely continue to stay there by choice. And on top of that, the amount of drama that they have is greatly smaller. I would say 20 times less than the amount of drama that there would be inside of some of these intentional communities that I visited. All right, so Paul, I've got a foundation.
It's an interesting, that last example, the old folks' home is, I wonder how much of that are drugs.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. And at the same time, I think that there's a lot of people that either are lightly medicated or not medicated, and they still choose to be there.
Yeah. Well, or their family dumped them off there, and they don't have a choice. But, I like the model because you have activities usually. People can get out of bed. They can go and do what they want. There's some sort of freedom to choose what you're going to do. But there's also structure there. And there are people who are there to help make sure people are keeping in line. It's not just everyone doing what they want. There's actually a structure, and there's people whose job it is to do certain things. So like at your place, you'd like to have a kitchen commander, and that kitchen commander has a job. It's to keep that kitchen going. And if there's ever any doubt as to what's to happen in that kitchen, who's going to make the final call? It's going to be that kitchen commander, right?
I would say that, of course, the kitchen commander can be overridden by me, I suppose.
Well, sure. But in the kitchen, If the kitchen commander says, listen, we need butter, you're not gonna bring something else. You need butter.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. Yes. I'm with you.
All right. So what would you like me to talk about?
Well, I think that, I mean, the,
Well,
the big thing is that this is a huge topic.
It's huge.
It's enormous.
Huge.
And I think that the thing is, when designing communities, rather than starting with a framework that has been demonstrated to work poorly,
yeah.
And although there are examples of people that keep it working, even though it's not working really well, mm-hmm. And I even believe that there can be consensus-based systems that can continue to work. Although I could probably spend a podcast talking just about consensus. But you know, the key is that I think that there's going to be Domenhur. Are you familiar with Domenhur?
No.
Okay, so Domenhur is this community that's located in Italy. They have, I'm going to say, a spiritual core, which I have to admit I've never been able to quite wrap my head around it. But they seem to support all different religions and spiritual beliefs, while at the same time kind of gluing them together with their own glue. And they have, I believe, last I heard, was over 1,000 people living there, and these are dominantly artists. So when you want to talk about drama, who brings more drama to the table, an engineer or an artist? I would say the artist. So I think that the challenge is extremely high. And at the same time, they are getting along. Each house has 20 people in it, not 12, not 30, but 20 people in it. So, so they've got a system that is working. And so it's like, wow, well, what are they doing that's working? And it is not a consensus-based system. On the other hand, there's a lot of elements to it that are very fascinating. Their days are scheduled all day long. And there's not a lot of time to go, and if you're going to be a drama-like person, there's not a lot of time in the day to go and express your drama, you know, to track somebody down, and I'm going to be all drama on you. There's not time for that. So that's part of it, I believe, is part of it, is that you're just so busy that, you know, there's just not opportunity to you know, say, now I want everybody to do something different.
Well, it's a great... Absolutely. So in my background, I used to be a Catholic monk, and my particular order was originally founded in the 1200s, but my branch was renewed, let's just use that word, in the 1500s. So the group I've been with has been working since the 1500s, and they do not use consensus, although I would say guided consensus, meaning the community has input. But one structure they have within it is, you know, you have the people who have been in there long term. So there's a point where you take final vows or solemn vows, they call it. And at that point, you're a full-fledged member. If you are a newbie, you don't have voting rights. I mean, you have input. You can. They always, in fact, written into what's called the rule, the way of life, it says, listen to the youngest of among you. You know, kind of like out of the mouths of babes. It's important to listen because they have insight that maybe the older generations don't have. But as far as keeping the peace, they just really don't give too much power to the newbies. You know, they have to, for the long term, allow the people who've lived there and put the sweat and tears in over the many years, and joy, of course, to have more of a say. All right, then on top of that, they have someone in charge of each monastery who we would call a guardian, whose job was to be like a father. To, you know, in the household when you're growing up, usually the dad's in charge, or it could be the mother, but one of the parents, if there are two parents, usually has the final say. And, you know, when I was growing up, it was my grandfather, and he would keep the peace sometimes with the old belt. Now, they didn't use that in the monastery. But anyway, the guardian was there to keep the peace. And really, they had always had someone in place that was not a pushover, who was fair, could listen to each side of the story. You know, and that really did work. And the other thing that you mentioned that totally worked and exactly what you're saying about the artists is they had a very strict schedule. You knew 7 days a week what was going to happen, when and where. And there were times for work, times for play, times for prayer, times for eating, for cleaning. I mean, everything was scheduled. And you had free time, but not a lot of it. And as far as the drama, there really was not a lot of time for that. I mean, of course, it creeped in. But again, the common purpose, though, you know, we were a spiritual group. That was the thing that kind of, that's why we were there. That because that was understood clearly. If you weren't into that, you weren't going to survive very long.
So now I've got a couple of things I want to toss in with
sure.
what you've just said. One is that I visited one community that was a consensus-based community, but really there was a matriarch. There was a woman there, and she wasn't there when I was visiting the community. But I asked the people, like, okay, tell me about your consensus. Tell me about decisions. Tell me about conflict. Tell me about when things were going wonky, what you would do. And pretty much the answers, you know, they would say a lot of things, but at the core of it, they would just do whatever she wanted. They just trusted her. And so then consensus basically worked. And I've also visited a farm where they had technically consensus, but there was a guy that everybody basically trusted. And then along those lines, I want to talk a moment about how I was visiting with a woman, and she was telling me about how when she was a teenager, and she went to a Catholic school, and it's like, oh, we hated those nuns, ah, and I'm sure you've never heard anybody say that before, but it's this Catholic school, there's all these things going on, but there was this guy, and I don't know what this word even means, the Monsignor.
Yes.
What does Monsignor mean anyway?
Well, technically, he's a butler of the Pope.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but he's, it's just a title of, it's a, I don't know the proper word, but anyway, it's just a...
The important
yeah.
thing that I got out of this, which I thought was really fascinating, and it is really important, is that nobody wanted to ever upset the Monsignor. I mean, the worst thing that could happen is that he would give you a disappointed look, and nobody wanted that.
Well, he's in charge. Yeah, he's in charge of the parish. You know, he's the number one guy within a church. Not every church has a Monsignor, but typically the Monsignor's the pastor. He's the pastor
okay.
of the church.
All right. All right. Well, and I suppose that there could be some guys that are in this role or are more charming than others.
Sure.
But in this particular case, it had nothing to do with this guy's position, his rank, his title, or whatever. It had everything to do with how this guy is such a thoroughly lovely man that nobody... could ever, because it's like you start talking about like what would be your punishment or something like that, and there's the belt was mentioned earlier. A belt! And so it's kind of like, all right, so what would be your punishment? What control do you have in this role? And especially if you're talking about like, I don't know, there could be 100 people in the staff and 400 kids, you know, and it's kind of like, how do you maintain control over this? And it sounded rather amazing to hear this woman telling me about it, because just the idea of disappointing this man was the tool. You did not want to get the disappointing look, the disappointed look from this guy, which was doled out extremely rarely. And just the idea of, like, you may have done something that's borderline wrong, and a nun is telling you that's not okay, and then you're like, oh yeah, and it's like, well, maybe we should take this up with the Monsignor. No.
Well, because built into that, Paul, is within the Catholic Church you have confession. You know, you go and you confess your sins to Monsignor, and he's the guy that's going to tell you, you know, how many Hail Marys to say, or you know, whatever. So
okay,
and the confessional is a very scary thing. So I think a lot of that has to do with, well, I'm going to tell Monsignor that you've been naughty, and are you going to be confessing that to him, or are you not? Because, you know, it's kind of like the nuns are famous, and it's horrible to even talk this way because they're wonderful people, but, you know, the stereotype is that they're mean and they're looking down at you with their pointed finger. I'm sure my brother could tell you about that, but
they've got a ruler and your knuckles.
Yeah, ruler, knuckles, sometimes the rosary, you know, all this stuff, but in general, you know, that's the old school church where you're supposed to, you know, feel guilty, blah blah blah. That's a whole other topic.
I guess I just wanted to paint this picture just really quickly.
Yeah.
That it didn't sound like to me from having this woman convey this that it had anything to do with any of that. It had everything to do
not wanting to disappoint
with just the personality of this man.
Yeah.
Didn't have anything to do with anything else. It just had to do with the fact that this guy was regarded as such an amazing person, as such a decent person, as just the core of goodness, not because of his title, just because of who he is and how he behaved. And something about him was so good that the idea of getting a disappointed look from him would just, you know, blacken your core.
Well, I would say they're very lucky to have that gentleman there. They're, you know, because how many groups have someone like that? If they do, they're very lucky. And like in our group, they would always pick someone like that, you know, someone who lived the life, who they didn't pick a jerk. They picked someone who was an example of what living that life was supposed to be like. And so you kind of used him as the model. You want to be like the person in charge. You know, like this is the next thing about community is, especially like religious life. Look at anyone who has the thought that because you're a priest or a nun, you're in a monastery and everything's going to be peachy keen. The truth is the monastery is filled with human beings. So you have every human emotion, you know, and it's so people want power. People, you know, it's just like being in a corporation, no different.
People want cookies.
Yeah. Yeah.
People want pie.
They want pie. So, you know.
You should have more pie. Here at the monastery, there should be more pie. And it's like, no, we're not going to get more pie. But think of the pie. Something like that. So yes, different people have different things that they want, and yet it's like this is how we roll here at this monastery, and right.
So like the corporation, how do corporations work? Usually there's someone in charge,
and that's a good point to bring up also, because like with a corporation or any kind of workplace, then you're going to have a group of people that are spending about half of their waking life in there, and they're going to be able to roll with it, to be able to do it, to be able to, you know, be okay with being there and getting along with others to a certain extent. And then in some places, it's like not a very fun thing to be part of. And in other places, it can be. And, you know, that's another thing to look at. Do you want to live this way all the time? Like working, I mean, I'm sure that there are many people who have been in work environments where they're like, man, this is such a great job. I love coming to my job. It's so much better than being at home. I kind of wish my job could go on and on all day. You know, it's kind of a drag at 5 o'clock, people go home. Whereas, you know, most jobs, I think, are not that way.
Well, and the truth is, you know, you might have someone in charge, and the truth is that not one person is more important than the other. You might have a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar corporation, and you might think, wow, he or she's the most important person. But you know what? If that janitor doesn't put toilet paper in the bathroom, there are going to be a lot of upset people. So I always say, and I tell us because we have a local permaculture group, you know, we each have a role. And like, if everyone had the role of the bee pollinating things, then my gosh, I mean, who would do the other stuff? We can't all be down the dirt digging holes and planting trees. Someone kind of needs to be the overseer. Some people need to be marketing. Some people need to be doing podcasts. you know, so at where I live, Joey is the one that he's down in the dirt, and he has the plan, and he is the dirty permie, you know. Literally, he has dirt on his hands, under his fingernails every single day. I don't think I do. Well, I know I don't. But I have a role, and I think that, you know, as you, because some people sit there like, well, gee, I'm in this permaculture group, and I don't know what I can do. It's because they don't, they might be brand new. They haven't learned yet about this stuff. It's like, look, you're, by you asking your questions as a brand newbie, you are helping the quote-unquote leader, the teacher, to think, oh, gee, I haven't expressed that properly. What's another way to say what I'm trying to teach you? And each time we have a podcast, especially with Joey, every time we talk, it expands his mind, and he gets so excited because he gets to think about permaculture in a way he hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, I mean, you start to refine your message.
After you've
said the same message 100 times, on the 100th time, your message is clearer than it was on the first time. And on top of that, it might be even slightly different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
so
all right.
Go ahead, Paul. What's on your list?
We've got half an hour to go, and I've got like 170 hours of things to put into here. So I was served on a board of an intentional community incubator. And the idea was to help many communities get started. And I would sit in on these meetings where people were talking about, you know, we're going to have a community and it's going to be like this and stuff like that. And it was, the number one problem that they had is that they would design their systems for everybody to be above normal, to be an exceptionally awesome. And I think what you need to do is you need to design your systems in such a way that they're going to work with people that are very human. So for example, here's a great example. I've heard it many, many times. As people were forming their communities, and I would try to dissuade this, but I was usually told, no, 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 I'm wrong and they're right. And so that if you live in a community of, say, 10 people, let's say you're one of 10 people, and you serve a meal, and you thus provide 10 plates of food, one plate for yourself and 9 other plates of food, then the expectation is that if you, you know, the next day, that somebody else will do a very similar thing and you will partake. So the idea is that if you provide 10 plates of food, then in time you will, you know, you've provided one for yourself and 9 others, that in time you'll get 9 plates of food returned to you.
Are you saying that the one person who's cooking actually buys the food? Are you talking about money? Or are you talking about...
Yeah. We could talk about money. We could talk about effort. We can talk about... But pretty much what I'm trying to talk about is the act of being noble versus the act of being entirely human.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing I would express to these people that are talking about this, that they don't need a system for the food because everybody will chip in equally and it'll all be wonderful. And the thing that they were very emphatic about was that if you provide people are just that good. And the thing that I would say was that I think that if you provided 9 plates of food, you might get 1 or 2 back, and you might then find that the people that are contributing to your community might find their resources quickly drained, and then they don't want to be part of the community anymore. I think you need to come up with a system of how things can be handled a little bit more fairly. And I was pretty universally shouted down as, this is not true, all people are good. And so I conducted an experiment myself. I joined a community, and I did not have this conversation. They did not know about my past experience on serving on this board or these conversations. And what I did was is that I hired somebody within the community that was a professional cook to prepare 9 meals per week. Now, you know, if you count 3 meals a day, there's 21 meals per week. So I provided 9 per week, all organic, all exceptionally, amazingly delicious. This cook was a very good cook. And I asked, the only thing I asked for in return was that people wash their own plate and to help out a little bit with the kitchen cleanup. That's all I asked for in return. I did also ask, since we were at a wilderness college, I also asked that people provide 1 wild food item per week. So, but I lined it up. I set a schedule. So Monday through Friday would be breakfast, and then Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday I would provide dinner. So over a 3-month period of time, I provided 540 plates of food to people other than myself. So I put out 540 plates of food. Now, Paul, I want you to take a guess at how many plates I received in return.
0?
That's actually a very close guess. I received 2.
Wow.
I received 2. And so I conducted this experiment in order to help move thought forward as people are designing their systems and expecting a certain kind of human nobility, human decency. They're saying people will be, as a fact, they will be this decent. And of course, and then the other thing is that I did set forward the expectation that somebody would, like, once a week bring in a fish. That there's a creek running right through the property. Bring in a fish. Or, you know, maybe some blackberries. You know, they're growing wild on the property. Maybe some nettles also growing wild on the property. You know, a variety. I mean, they're learning about all these wild edibles in their day-to-day classes. And not everybody was a student either. There were several people that are living on the property that were, you know, in their 40s and things like that. And they weren't students. So it was kind of like, all right, so this is my expectation. This is what I ask in return.
Well, as long as that's expressed. See, originally when you mentioned it, it kind of sounded like, well, the expectation was set. Like, well, we're going to have this cook and the meals are going to be provided. You're the Santa Claus of, you know, dinners.
It's clear that I do not own the property, that I do not have any say in the overall greater community or anything like that. I am a community member.
Yeah.
And the key is that I'm making it clear. I'm not saying that I expect other people to prepare meals, you know, for me. I'm saying, you know, that I'm hoping to plant a seed to start community living. So, but I did have the expectation that people would bring in wild food
right.
One time.
Right.
So I think we ran the math one time, and it's like we should have received wild food on 90 occasions, and we got wild food in on 6 occasions. So and on top of that, it opened up some interesting things I did not foresee. I mean, people usually wash their own plate. It was only towards the end when people started helping out with the dishes for preparation a little bit. In the beginning, they did not. But somebody kept pointing out that, hey, this is the deal, you know, come on, help out. One of the problems that cropped up that I did not see coming is that we had somebody stealing food. So outside of when I was providing meals.
That's very common. Very common.
So
put it on your list, everyone. Food stealer budget, you know.
Set up a budget to reward the dishonest. I guess the point I want to make is that when we design our community systems, we have to embrace that people will be like, I just don't have time to cook. And you know what? I can't be bothered to even think about what other people eat. And I mean, all the different kinds of bits of information that go into this. I can't be bothered to try and shop for people. I can't be bothered to whatever. I've got other things to do. My life's more important than that, you know. And the list of reasons/excuses on why people cannot do this thing, which seems like it would be a fair thing, you know, is immense. And then, yes, they justify to themselves why they can have food from another person without reciprocating. And that is, I believe, human nature. As
you know, what's the solution, Paul Wheaton?
Well, I think that I mean, the way that when you were living in the monastery, this was not a problem.
It worked very well, and that's because everything was scheduled and everyone had a role, and everyone contributed. I'm thinking mostly of the second year where we had a commercial kitchen, commercial dishwasher, and you couldn't squeeze 18 people behind the dishwasher, you know, so we kind of split the teams up. So we had, you know, the people behind the dishwasher, we had people wiping the tables, other people sweeping the floor, another group would clean out the refrigerators, and it was done every single meal, every single time. There was never a time when it wasn't done. We didn't say, oh, we'll do that later. That's another thing. A lot of people say, oh, we'll do that next time. Well, then it's just twice as much work next time.
Right, right.
So that worked very well, definitely. And the food part, the first year we had, I think there were 17 people living in the house. Well, yeah, 17. And everyone basically cooked twice a month. Now, the food was provided, you know, we had a common pantry, and, you know, there was no money involved. So it was everyone's responsibility for cooking for that many people, and that there was enough food for that many people every single time they cooked. Now, the 18-year-old guy, the first time he cooked, he had no clue how to cook for 17 people. And he literally made chicken McNuggets and baked potatoes. And the baked potatoes, I'm like, did you cook them long? I said, oh, yeah. I'm like, well, how long? He's like, oh, yeah, I cooked them long. How long? 5 minutes. And, oh, my gosh. He had zero experience. The food was horrible. But that's where this mentoring comes in and teaching people the ropes. And, you know, eventually he learned how to cook for 17 people edible food. The first time it was not edible. So, but you're right, Paul. I mean, when you provide food, they're going to steal it. It's horrible to say that, but they somehow feel they're entitled. So, like, my second experiment in community living, I decided, well, I'm not going to participate in the food. I'm going to have, because I lived in a trailer, I had my own refrigerator and everything. It's like, we don't need to have that food element together. We had other ways to be together. And I think that worked great because, unfortunately, I'm the one I feel is taken advantage financially a lot when it comes to food, even with friends, you know, go out and somehow I'm the one that is always paying. I don't like that. So I had to learn over time, you know, how do we make it more balanced and stuff. So,
right. I it is a complicated space and it is awkward and I think that there's a lot of solutions out there, but you gotta start with the idea of people are human, and as opposed to, like, you know, having this expectation that everybody will be noble, and then designing the system based on people being that level of noble or that level of decent, so in which case, yeah, you got to design this. All right, I think that the thing to do is that for example, in the old folks' home, then everybody pays an amount of money to be there, and then with it comes food. There's none of this. When you show up to eat, there's at no point in time does somebody say, like, well, who's paying tonight? Or, you know, let's go grocery shopping. Or we have to go buy the food to feed everybody. Or any of this. If it's all taken care of. The food is included in the deal.
Right.
You know, and so then, you know, that's another thing, too, is that when you look at a lot of community stuff, or especially when you look back to college days, or, you know, when you're 18 years old and living with four of your buddies, it's kind of like, I think that the kitchen was where probably 90% or more of the problems came from. So if you can just fix all the kitchen stuff, then suddenly people get along so much better.
Listen to this, Paul. Not to interrupt, but when I was in college, we had these friends, these girls, and their solution to what you just said about the food, like, they would buy oranges, and they would write their name on the orange. This is Rebecca's orange. I'm like, oh, my gosh. So there's extremes. So there's kind of like a balance. I like the convalescent home thing where, well, you know, that food's provided and... But you pay for it.
Then somebody will write Rebecca's orange on it, and then there are some people that are wired in such a way that the orange that has somebody else's name written on it tastes better than the orange with my name on it. And they get a certain thrill from it, and then when Rebecca catches them in the act, then they tell Rebecca that, I'll get you another orange, just you know... Chill. Take it easy. What's the big deal? I'll get you another. Look, you know what? I know you spent 50 cents for that orange. Here's 50 cents. Go buy yourself a new orange, all right? It'll be fresher. So it's a disrespect, effectively.
Yes.
And I think that's an important thing to bring up in community, too. I mean, once little teeny tiny forms of disrespect start to show up, they quickly grow into, I mean, they're basically seeds. They're disrespect seeds. And they grow into these monstrosities of disrespect. But, all right, when it comes to meals, I do want to mention a quick upside. And that is that I once lived in a community. We had 11 people living under one roof. And we divided all the food, even Stephen. And the food came back at $108 per person per month. And it was all organic, very strictly organic.
Wow, that's great.
But we didn't buy prepared foods. Everything was raw ingredients, and then somebody was cooking the meals every night and every morning. So, there's a big perk. We saved an enormous amount of money by going down this path. I think it turns out to be the case frequently. When I did the experiment of feeding all those people for 3 months, I think I averaged, sometimes there'd be like 10 or 12 people at the table, but I think it was average of about 5 at each meal that I was paying for. It ended up not being as expensive as you might think, just because of this factor of, like, you know, when you have somebody who knows how to cook and you buy things in bulk and you stick to organic and you're buying the raw ingredients instead of buying a bunch of prepared food, then you do save a lot of money.
Like, we had one guy, so we were supposed to cook twice a month in the first year, and the second year we actually had a cook, and that was great too. But the year that we were supposed to cook, we had this guy. He was a student. He was very, his schedule did not allow him to cook twice a month. He could only cook once a month. But when he cooked, it was incredible because he could take everyone's leftovers and he could turn those leftovers into a magical, incredible meal. And he would cook quantities so that basically he cooked enough for the next. He cooked twice a month in one day. And we loved it when he cooked because it was just so delicious. And he could turn those leftovers into just, he could open a restaurant with that stuff. It's really good. Really, really good.
I think that there are some people that have mad skills in community cooking, and which is kind of like, you know, where I get to the system, which you alluded to earlier, of having a kitchen commander, and
yeah,
so then this would be a paid person.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so, you know, basically each person, it's kind of like if you've got a functioning farm or functioning community in such a way that it has an income stream, then it's kind of like, okay. Because I also remember when I was like 18, working at the Tubbs Ranch, and you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and food was served at 5:15, and it was amazing and delicious. And there were like these three women that cooked this enormous meal for the 30 of us that were about to start this shift. And then we would go out and work, and then this amazing lunch was brought out to the field. And then when we're all done for the day, then we go back, and there's an amazing meal that's provided again. And so we all got fed exceptionally well. And the pay was really, really low, but we got free food and a free place to stay. So it worked out exceptionally well. And I thought, what an amazingly brilliant model for things to work. And of course, they had a business. They were raising peas and wheat, and that, those are their big crops that they would ship out. And this is a model they came up with in order to be able to pull this off. And I think that there's a lot to be said for a similar model. Much like the guy you're talking about, that's such a great cook. It's like, okay, how do we work things out? So that guy is our cook, and then some other people might have other skills, and if somebody has no skills at all,
right,
it turns out that there's jobs for them too.
Right.
Not the most glamorous or interesting jobs. So it can all work out, I think. I know that we are embarking on an experiment here at my place where, yes, we are still looking to hire a kitchen commander, somebody who can cook and somebody who can do exactly what you said, turn yesterday's leftovers into a magnificent meal today. And then they cook plenty, so that way it's like, oh, and then this is going to subsidize future meals. And there are people that are amazing that way. I've eaten these meals. I've been there. I know that they're out there. And we just need to find somebody that's bonkers enough about permaculture to want to come and live here and do that. And we just haven't found that person yet. But this will be a different kind of community, not a consensus-based. I suppose that in many ways it would be similar to what you've experienced, which is hierarchical.
Yeah.
The thing that I've advocated is that this system here would be a hybrid between independent work and consensus, and then evil dictator. So... well, most of the stuff, you would do it through independent. You would independently come to the conclusion that, nobody cares. I'll just go ahead and do this.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you think, oh, these people are going to care. I'm going to go talk to them. And then if you get consensus, then you just keep going. And then like 1% or 2% of the time, it's like, we can't reach consensus. We got to take it to the evil dictator.
Right. We only have about 6 minutes left, and I know we could talk for hours and hours, and like you mentioned something called founder's syndrome. I don't want you to talk about it now because I don't think we have enough time, do we?
No, I think founder's syndrome is a very important thing for a lot of communities, and I think it takes a certain kind of person to start a community, to found a community, and there's a lot of hard work involved, and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of hours to get a community started and off the ground. Then you've got 20 people there, and then 19 of these gentle souls will come to the conclusion there's one person in our community that's kind of type A, kind of a jerk, kind of, always talking about the taxes and government things and rules, and always a downer. And that, of course, is the founder. And so it took this certain personality to found a community. And it turns out that once you bring together a bunch of people that love community, that they tend to not like that kind of personality. So I saw this a lot. They would eject that person because in the world of consensus, they had to have a system on how to eject a person that founded the community, or how to eject a person that wasn't a fit for the community. So everybody else pretty much came to the agreement that person should go. And it was such a common thing that we now have the expression founder's syndrome. And I don't know, I've visited with, like, I think 6 different people that founded the community and then were ejected by the community. I just find it to be such an amazingly fascinating thing that that can happen. On the other hand, sometimes the community does have somebody that got in that is a bad apple and you need to get them out. And then, of course, people change. Sometimes a lovely person moves in, and then they change to be a not-so-lovely person. So there needs to be this mechanism to get the some people to leave. That's going to be the best solution, is if this one person leaves. I'm familiar – well, anyway, so that's founder syndrome. I think it's something to always, you know, keep in your mind. I'm also familiar with a community that was run by Consensus, and everything worked very smoothly for like 2 years because they had one person that they basically trusted and they followed that one person. And then one of the people in the community decided that they didn't want to follow that person anymore. And so that one person, this new person, said, no, we're Consensus and I block. I hereby block. And everybody in the community ended up leaving except for this one new person, the blocking person. And then that one person was the only person on this property. And finally, the organization that managed this property told her that we can't get anybody else to come onto the property because of you. And so finally, they evicted her, and then the property sat empty for like 8 months until people finally started to come back. So the moral of the story is that you need to design a community in such a way. I think you need to, because a lot of the communities that would eject their founder would find that the jobs that needed to get done that nobody liked were now not getting done. Like, you know, paying taxes and paying for the mortgage and paying for the utilities. And that somehow this person found ways to get those things done. And then those communities would oftentimes fold shortly after. Now, I've heard of a few communities that ejected their founder, and they're still doing fine. But founder syndrome, you know, ended up burning all parties involved, generally. Not universally, but generally.
We have 2 minutes left, Paul. Do you want to keep going? We can go on, or we could just say part two coming next time.
Oh, we could do part two. I should mention that, yeah, I've got a Kickstarter going on now.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What's going on?
I've got the permaculture playing card. So 54 cards packed with information about permaculture out at Kickstarter. And I think that if you go to permies.com/cards, that will show you the page that's got all the information on it. But we're currently talking about stretch goals because we've already met our first goal, and we're going to put together a stretch goal so that if we get, you know, this many dollars, then we're going to work to replace 3 of the current queens with actual women. And so we're currently having discussions about, well, which women will we put in there? So they want all 4, because we currently have one of the queens is Ruth Stout, the goddess of mulch. And we've got 3 other queens, and they're like, one of the queens is currently Comfrey. But we'll shuffle the cards around to, you know, to try and make room, and then the other 3 will be we'll have 4 of the greatest women in permaculture to be listed as all the queen face cards. And then we're also got another stretch goal that if we get even more money, we're looking into the numbers and we're chomping on the numbers, and we think that we're going to be able to give everybody who has purchased a brick, which is 12 decks, to get a double brick.
Wow.
So twice as many cards.
Come on, everyone. You got to buy it because I already bought a brick. I'd love to have 2. And they're beautiful. I mean, go look at the Kickstarter. The cards are really neat. It's an awesome idea, and I definitely know, like, my family, they play poker. So I want to introduce this to the family so that they can kind of understand what Paul's always talking about. But, you know.
I think the primary function of these cards is that when you're a permaculture person and you're trying to, like, tell somebody else about permaculture, they don't get it, they're not interested. Whereas if you hand them a deck of cards, they can thumb through them, and hopefully in a few seconds we'll get them hooked to thumb through the rest. So it's a So its primary function is to help other people understand permaculture. That way you look less crazy.
Right. And they're beautiful. So I definitely think that people should look at it and consider it. Christmas is coming. Paul, are they going to be out for sure by Christmas, or you don't know?
We're shooting for November.
Yeah.
I think we can do it.
All right. Well, because you've already raised the initial money, and in theory, well, let's everyone go out and buy some more cards, and then we'll get it done. Paul Wheaton is going to be on Permaculture Voices convention or convergence. I don't know what do they call it, Paul?
Conference. The Permaculture Voices Conference.
Conference. That's next March. Go to permaculturevoices.com for more information. It's a huge panel of cutting-edge leaders within permaculture, and it's there's nothing ever been like this before, so I highly recommend going to look at that. And any last-minute announcements, Paul?
My Rocket Mass Heater DVDs are out and
right.
Selling well. You got yours?
I did. We started watching them. It's very, very informative, for sure.
Good. Well, they're out. They're ready. Those are up for sale. So.
All right. And there's a link to that on this episode page, the Blog Talk Radio. All right, Paul. Thank you so much. I love this topic. And maybe we should have several more on this topic. But take, one topic for each. So work, chores, meals, living accommodations, money, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's so many different components and aspects of it. It's pretty good.
It's huge.
Yeah. All right, my friend.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye.